substance equals spurn. The propaganda's a win, stress feeding on my tension. My countrymen, they love their fiction. Words are now displayed with good intentions.
Okay, welcome back to One of 200. This is a midweek issues episode. We have me, Philip, interviewing Kieran. Kelly, welcome back. Kieran, thanks so much for making time for our New Zealand International Politics podcast. You've been on a few times talking about your On Genocide work. Go to ongenocide.com, find his blogs, fantastic. Yeah, how are you feeling in this wintry?
Oh, kia ora, I'm feeling good. I did have a slight incident the other day. I was chopping pumpkins and German Chancellor Merz came on the news to say that Israel was doing a dirty job for all of us.
Wow.
Which got me so agitated that I chopped the tip of my finger. So other than that, pretty good. It's not hurting as much as it was, but yeah.
Greatest crime committed by Mets so far.
Oh, yeah, probably.
Another war crime on the heap.
I'm definitely a victim of Nazism now. Cause, yeah.
That's hilarious. Anyway. That's hilarious. Yeah. Amazing. Just add a personal touch to the damage, eh? I love that.
Yes. Now it's serious for me. Now it's personal. Yeah.
This time it's personal. Yeah. Awesome. Thanks so much for making time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. No worries.
I know you've been traveling all around the motu, as we say. But I was thinking, why don't we start by you just telling us what you've been up to? You've had an exciting few weeks, to say the least. So tell us a story, Kieran.
Yeah, so decided to go and join the Global March for Gaza in Egypt. So this was fairly last minute. I think it was last minute for everyone, but if you're coming from Aotearoa, you've got a bit further to go. It's a bit more logistically complex than people who are popping over from Europe. So yeah, went to Egypt, Cairo, and then at a certain point in time, which is June the 13th, and that, you know, we tried to move from Cairo to a town called Ismailia, where we were hopefully going to go across the Suez in the tunnel through the Suez to go to Al Arish and then march from Al Arish, which is on the Mediterranean coast of the Sinai Peninsula, march from there 45 kilometers to Rafah. So we know Rafah in Gaza. It's actually, there's Egyptian Rafah as well on the other side of the border. So we wouldn't be right at the border, which would be obviously rather dangerous. We would be near the border. We would rally there. We would, perform basically a symbolic process of drawing attention to things. We were going to be, this was timed to coincide with the Freedom Flotilla and also timed to coincide with the Sumud convoy, which came from Tunisia and then through Algeria. And they were supposed to meet up with us. They were bringing aid and trucks. We were just bringing ourselves, basically, and we were going to stay there and rally. That was the plan anyway. It didn't quite happen that way. Which, I mean, to be fair, is not surprising. We were told originally, like, these are the dates we're going to be doing things, but plan for another to stay another week because we haven't got permission yet from the Egyptian government, and we don't know if we will get permission before, on the day. There is no way into the Sinai without going through military checkpoints, and there was never any intent to do this without the Egyptian government's permission. The feeling was that once we were there, there would be, we would be kind of reporting back to our home countries. There would be some attention in the Arabic press and so forth, that might induce the Egyptian government to decide to let us do this, to facilitate it for us or for even just a token group from our number. I was quite prepared to go there and to spend that time with other activists from all around the world and to sort of do some videos or write some stuff or, otherwise network and stuff and share to raise awareness, even if I wasn't marching in the Sinai. The day we were meant to leave, we were originally told we would be getting on buses at 8 in the morning in Old Cairo. And so we're supposed to rendezvous there with the others in the New Zealand contingent and then hop on buses and go to this place, Ismailia, by the Suez Tunnel, and hopefully onwards from there. Then we were told it would be 12 noon, and then we were told to await instructions. It would be sent out by telegram, and then there was meant to be 10 a.m., and then basically at about 20 past 11 or something, I can't remember exactly, but I think it was getting quite late in the piece, we got a message through, which is basically everyone jump in a taxi and go to Ismailia, which is 2 hours away, 2 hours drive away. And it's a Friday, which of course is the day off for a lot of people in Islamic countries. And suddenly you've got 4,000 people wanting a taxi. Yeah.
It's like after Elton John concert in downtown Auckland, only with serious stakes.
Yes, yes. We're here. So it was, you know, beginning in chaos already. But even before then, we'd actually, when we went to rendezvous at the hotel where some other Kiwis were staying, we were approached by undercover cops. And so we're sitting outside the hotel with our bags and stuff like that. And two of them come over to us. And they were fine. But the one thing that was a bit kind of eerie about it was that there were Egyptians standing around us. And they kind of walked over and flicked their fingers. And the people all just went away without a word, you know. And didn't ask, what's this about? They didn't speak. They just went. And it was kind of between that and the cops and their trucks and the body armor and the barricades everywhere, you kind of really understand that this is quite a, let's say, a security conscious or perhaps a speech conscious country. You know. So yeah, it's not legal to demonstrate. 181 activists so far have been detained indefinitely for pro-Palestine activism, and they're detained without charge, which keeps being rolled over. Wow. The week we were there, several young men were sentenced to 2 and 3 year sentences for pro-Palestine graffiti. So
wow.
They take it very seriously. On the other hand, we weren't there to demonstrate. We weren't there trying to have any impact on the local Egyptian people or their politics. So, you know, we signed a piece of paper saying we would respect Egyptian law. We were going there for purely peaceful intents and purely legal activities. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting and kind of difficult with these intermediary countries, right, where you're not there to explicitly kind of challenge their norms and legal standards, but you are there to make a point, right? And how does that work as an activist or a set of activist organizations?
Well, I think that, you know, obviously the situation is far more acute and far more serious with Egypt, because of its proximity and because it is the only country with a border, apart from Israel, of course, with Gaza. So it is very important, but ultimately their position is no different than virtually all of the countries in the world. They say they're against the genocide, they demand a ceasefire, and then they provide material support for that genocide. The same as our government here. So I wasn't going there to do civil disobedience and or all that sort of stuff. You know, we have a perfectly fucking evil government here to do that if I was so inclined, you know. You know, I'd become a terrorist by throwing some paint on some planes or something like that, you know.
Yeah, you can get arrested at home, right? You don't need to fly.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got domes that need busting. We've got other shit that needs to happen, you know. So yeah, that wasn't the purpose of going there for me. I wasn't, you know, and you know, there's certainly there was, people were being picked up out of their hotels and out of cafes and then kind of held for 24 hours with some pretty rough treatment before being deported. We wanted to avoid that, but you know, obviously, so that was part of it. But I wasn't there to try and play cat and mouse games with the cops or anything like that, you know. We went with the purest of intentions, and so anyway, after we met these cops, we still hadn't had that message, and so we said we were going to go and find our hotel, because we told them we were looking for our hotel, which wasn't where we were, but they accepted it anyway. We wandered off in the wrong direction, not because we were trying to deceive them, but because I couldn't read my GPS. But anyway, we're kind of doing this big circle round, sort of vaguely getting more towards where we'd booked a hotel. We'd booked a hotel because we thought there could be delays before we left anyway. And we end up at Tahrir Square, not quite getting closer to our hotel, still not quite heading in the right direction. Then we're stopped again by a very nice policeman who says, you know, you can't go there. They're blocked off Tahrir Square at this point. So there's cops absolutely everywhere, right? So, you know, we explain where we're going, and then this woman with a backpack does a sort of stage whisper with one of the cops right there saying, "March for Gaza." Luckily, he didn't hear it. But she had, she was like Swiss Algerian, so from Geneva. She was a French speaker. And so, yeah, I had originally thought maybe it might be worth waiting for a bit to try and catch a taxi till the rush died down. But once we hooked up with her, we thought, well, we'll go straight away, which turned out to be probably the best thing. So we head out, we're driving. You know, we didn't realize it took 2 hours. Because, you know, but yes, we're driving for about an hour and a half. And then, so we've got a taxi driver with us. And yeah, you know, just taking in the sights, doing everything. And then we come to this, we've been through a toll thing. And then we come to what's obviously a checkpoint set up at a toll area. And then we're probably maybe 100, maybe 150 people milling around the side of the road there by a kind of police station-y thing with like these turrets with soldiers. There were some soldiers there as well as police at this stage, soldiers with AK-47s. So basically, you know, the car pulls over, they just grab everyone's passports and walk off with them. You know, they probably said something in Arabic to the driver, but we didn't understand. But he just went and parked and we walked back. And thank God we got there when there was only about 150 people, because I don't know where we would have ended up parking later. But anyway, so yeah, and like he runs around trying to find out. He didn't know why we were there. We kind of later sheepishly, once it all came out, we sheepishly told him, but he was very supportive anyway.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing. There's all the stuff out there about how the Egyptians hate us activists and beat up all these people. Those people were, if you've seen footage of people being attacked in a group, big sitting group at night, that was where I was. That was later on at night. So that's in the middle of the desert. There are no local people to wander along and get angry. They were bussed in there to soften them up so that the cops could get them on the buses without, I mean, I'm assuming, we know that there were violence from a gang linked, that affiliated with the government anyway. So we assume that they bussed people there and did that. And you can see at one point in the videos that like the cops come in and pull them back, like, you know these guys have had enough. So
that's,
it was
enough,
sort of controlled,
yeah,
by the police, you know. So and because there were, it looked like there were hundreds of people there, they were, had a bit more discipline than the rest of us, I'd say, as we'll talk about in a second. Yeah. So they would have been, you know, removing them by the cops alone would have maybe generated some video that didn't look very good.
Mm.
So yeah, we arrive up at this place, and you know, they take and you know, they tell us, oh, it'll be an hour before you get your passports back. And you know, that an hour drags on, people start chanting passports back, passports back. And then like, you know, 5 minutes later, someone's got out their Palestine flag and it's free, free Palestine, free, free Palestine. And then the numbers just get building and building. And at some stage, at some point, they must have realized that it was way more people than they expected. So they set up checkpoints before ours. Now, I think there were possibly, I'd say, 1,000 to 2,000 people where we were.
Wow.
And we had not traveled to Egypt to do a massive rally and protest, but the Egyptian police did organize a very good and very disruptive rally. And because everyone, the whole time we were there for hours, people were just coming through, two cars at a time on this busy highway and they were backed up and they're going right through past like all these people waving Palestine flags and chanting. This isn't a country that wants to stop people from displaying pro-Palestine sentiment. So yeah, I really think that like I do believe like Extinction Rebellion could subcontract the Egyptian police to organize some of their disrupt. Would be quite good. One person who got a bit of focus was Nelson Mandela's grandson, who was there. It was very hot, but everyone was very cheerful. I heard that someone had a meltdown, but you know, everyone, you know, I can understand that. It's a you haven't got your passport, you don't know what's happening, but mostly the mood was pretty ebullient. And you know, eventually we realized, well, the thing is that we at first we were going to stay and get our passports back and just stay and hope that our numbers would get the Egyptian government to let us go further. Now, someone came over to where we're all milling around and chanting and, you know, yakking to each other and all of this sort of thing and said, you know, you need to stop this. You need to put the flags away. We didn't come here for this. We're over on the lawn. We're just sitting peacefully. We're demonstrating to the authorities that we don't mean to break any Egyptian law. We're here with the best of intentions and so forth, which was actually what we had planned in the first place. You know, didn't actually know who that person was. The French-speaking woman with us seemed to know who she was, but it wasn't like, yeah, this is the problem, I think, with having this distance between organisers. None of the organisers that I knew of were actually there apart from Nelson Mandela's grandson, and he hadn't made any public statements. So we just continued what we were doing. Yeah, so those people, there were at least a couple of hundred of them. They went and they sat peacefully there. Now, I think some of the French speakers were prepared for camping out or staying. We had been told that we would be marching and the water and food would be provided to us. So we had none of that. So we weren't really prepared. And after a while, we kind of realized that getting our passports back and then trying to go forward was probably not going to happen. So then we started the process of getting the passports back, which was kind of hilarious in itself because they had this office and it was just piled with all of these passports on desks. And they just had them sorted into countries or colours or whatever. And they just hand out big wadges to people who'd stand on things and try and yell out names while we've got all this chanting going on.
Oh, God.
So, and people are like, you know, what's normally a highway, of course, is like they're stopping the traffic, but we're crossing both sides of the road of necessity, you know, and blocking it. Eventually they did a ring of cops around it to stop us blocking the traffic too much. But it's still like you're ducking over and back and there's all this stuff in various different places. And yeah, this went on for some hours. And yeah, eventually we got our passports back and headed back to Cairo and then paid our driver a very handsome sum for that, which he thoroughly deserved.
An exorbitant waiting fee, yeah. Yeah.
Not quite as much as, you know, like a taxi with that, like, you know, with the old thing, like clock ticking over
leave it,
thing that they
the leave it running thing.
Yeah, 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 leave it running, yes, meter. Yes, but yeah, so, you know, I think he was happy. He offered to take us back at 5 o'clock in the morning when he reckoned they wouldn't be out. But, I mean, I think it was, you know, unless we could have gotten to Ismailia en masse and gathered there, there's not much point in us going in small dribs and drabs.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds a bit chaotic, right? I was going to ask in terms of organization, like if you say there wasn't a kind of clear command structure, there wasn't, you know, there wasn't an activist leadership there saying, you know, this is the next plan, the contingency plan or whatever. How did it kind of function internally?
I mean, it's obviously like a cell structure. There's for every 50 participants, there's supposed to be a delegate who's supposed to get messages. Our group was only 22. So we had someone who wasn't getting messages, but also we think, not really sure what exactly happened, but she disappeared from signal the whole day. Now, apparently she had been communicating but it wasn't getting through to us, which is quite weird and suggestive of some sort of shenanigans on someone's part, you know. So I had indications as well, like our batteries on our phones were running out so fast, and I couldn't access some sites, I couldn't sign into things, I couldn't reset passwords, I couldn't create new accounts.
Wow.
So it was, yeah, it was a little bit of a sense of, I mean, I saw something about the cyber attacks on Iran, you know, of course this all started happening while we were there. And people were, you know, just ordinary people was having similar difficulties. So you kind of think maybe that was, there's just a fairly wide net they cast of jiggery pokery.
Yeah.
Also, yeah, maybe unrelated, but we got back to Aotearoa, we got no data. And it turned out that when we'd switched, like, we started switched on data usage in Shanghai, like, it just went insane. And it might be that someone was scraping our entire phone. Kind of creepy. So I don't know, you know, people talk about taking burners so they don't get caught in, you know, at airport security and stuff like that. But I kind of wonder whether we don't have to just do that as just normal practice and not take your normal phone for these sorts of things.
Yeah, it's worrying, eh, the level of kind of technological interference that's possible these days. In terms of the Freedom Flotilla got a lot of more kind of headline press, at least in New Zealand. But that was, like you said initially, planned to line up, right? This is part of the same kind of strategy of breaking
Absolutely, yeah.
So why do you think that is? What is it that captures imagination about a boat that doesn't capture imagination about thousands of humans?
Oh, I think there's a tradition with the Freedom Flotillas. They have been going for a while. I did say there was precedent for a land convoy reaching there, which Kia Ora Gaza partook in 2010. Yeah, 2010. And this is why I think there was some belief that maybe there would be a change of heart by the Egyptian government, because Hosni Mubarak, after they waited around, admittedly for a much longer time than we were probably going to, but in smaller numbers, Hosni Mubarak allowed them to go, and they were going into Gaza. So you know, people from Aotearoa went into Gaza at that point, you know, which probably meant a lot to the people there. And we had no hope of doing that, obviously. And in a way, we're just trying to do a symbolic act. I mean, to try and remind people, to show everyone that people do care. And the fact is that given that we didn't really want to create a ruckus in Egypt, you have to wonder why it was so important to stop us. And I think that shows that it was actually a more powerful act than people are giving it credit for. And the Israelis didn't give Egypt a message directly about us, but about the Sumud convoy, they said, you have to stop these jihadis from going to the border there, you know? So, and it obviously is quite important to Israel to create this illusion of Palestinians as isolated, of a world that's on their side, of an Egypt that's on their side, of an Egyptian people who are on their side. These are all delusions that they create. But I've seen the commentary that's like, because these locals came to beat the activists up, the commentary suggesting that Egyptians hate Palestinians. And you kind of think, well, these people are absolutely deranged. They think that ordinary people are as racist and psychopathic as they are, and that they don't care about babies being starved to death and burned, and they don't care about desperate people being shot regularly at when they're trying to get food, or shelled, or, you know, tents being bombed. You know, this, the absolute carnage that's been unleashed, with 90% of the buildings being destroyed and so forth. You know, anyone with a heart is that isn't a heart that isn't polluted by ideologies of hatred is going to feel for the Palestinian people, for the people of Gaza at the moment. And the Egyptians, they might not be able to say anything, but they can watch. They have access to Al Jazeera Arabic, for example. And I don't think it's I think it's clear that their sympathies lie with the people who are the victims, for the most part. There were definitely some people were caught by the cops because hotel managers dobbed them in. And I think there are some Egyptians who are fearful of war with Israel. But I think they're a minority. They're kind of the, well, the boot-licking variety, the authority-loving minority. We stayed in a hotel in Old Cairo, and the first night there was no water in the fridge. You normally have bottled water where you go. And the next day, in the middle of the day, we get a knock at the door, and there's someone from housekeeping there, and she has this massive grin on her face, and she hands us the bottled water, and it's this brand O brand, and it's got a little map of Mandate Palestine with Philistine written in Arabic. So I mean, they must have figured out that we weren't, like, you know, we weren't Israelis or Zionists or whatever. They must have been worried, or because it didn't, even though it's like right on Tahrir Square, it didn't seem like a place where Westerners meant to stay. We did seem like a bit of a novelty. They enjoyed watching the way we ate, for example.
thousands of Westerners just showing up at the same time. I'm sure it's the topic of many dinner conversations at the time.
It's, yeah.
How many have you got, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it has been brutal and horrific to see the actual kind of ongoing, not just Gaza, but mostly Gaza, I suppose.
Yeah.
The Holocaust, as you quite rightly kind of described it. Mm-hmm. And then there was that recent Harvard study talking about 377,000 missing Palestinians and the daily massacres at aid collection locations that look, I think unambiguously deliberate as kind of traps set for desperate people. And we're well beyond any sense of, I guess, rescuing the humanity of this situation, I suppose. So really, I wanted to just sort of direct you towards how you're feeling from where to from here, from an international law perspective, right? Without putting too fine a point on it, like, how on earth do you come back to some kind of organized international system where things can make when everything's been flaunted to the nth degree and beyond, right? Like, how do you rescue any kind of global citizenry or justice or logic after this?
Well, I mean, that's the thing. It's the flaunting that creates this crisis, because we have had awful violations of international law by Western powers, the US particularly, in the past. But this is so, it's not only well documented, but it is far more systematic. And it began on day one. It didn't evolve, really. It was intense from the beginning, but done in a measured way so that it wouldn't be a complete collapse of the population immediately. So the attacks on food provision are a good example. So they began with a lot of bombings of bakeries, and then they would attack the people who were organizing food distribution. Sometimes they would attack food distribution points. They would attack people who started growing food and so forth. So they've been systematically attacking the means of feeding people so that they can reach a point where they can make it, like, they can essentially cull people, through starvation and violence at a level that just remains below what the Western media think is worth talking about. And this is unprecedented. The calculation involved is unprecedented. So, genocides are unfortunately all too common, but something like this is novel in the way that it's played out, in the level of premeditation, in the agility of switching from one track to another, in the redundancy of the ways of killing people, and again, not looking like they're slaughtering everyone, creating this horrible, slow system of population reduction through violence and starvation and disease and so forth, which is, in some ways an evolution of what they've been doing for a long time. A lot of people have been calling the actions towards Palestinians a slow genocide for a long time. It has, this is why I use the term Holocaust with Gaza, because the Palestinian genocide goes back to 1947. If you look at the way genocide is defined in the United Nations Convention on the Crime and Punishment of, Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, the things that they've been doing since then, and especially since 1967, and even more so since 1987, fit the description with extreme ease, with the proviso that you have to say that, like everyone, you cannot accept the pretext that these are measures carried out for security reasons.
Mm.
Because everyone says that. If you're going to commit genocide, you're always going to say that it's for security reasons. That doesn't mean you don't have genocidal intent. If you're organizing something that systematically causes destruction in part of a national group like this, it's genocide. And you can't, how could it happen without intent when it's happening over such a long period? If there was a month of it, you could say, oh, no, we were trying to fight the PLO or Fatah or the PFLP or Islamic Jihad or but you know, if it's just one thing after another for decades and decades and decades, if you have this incredibly racist ideology, and if you're taking over the land of these people and blatantly settling it, if you have like people saying, well, you know, we need to get rid of these people. And if people talk about the target, the victim population is a demographic threat that has to be dealt with, then the genocidal intention is there. And you do not need all of the things that have happened since October the 7th, 23. Yeah, my brain is really not processing dates and numbers very well at the moment.
That's right. Blame Matt. Your brain your brain is leaking out of your finger.
Yeah, absolutely. But, yes.
Don't blame yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. You don't need all of the things that have happened since then to prove genocidal intent at all. It was already there. The genocide was ongoing. This orgy of violence is a Holocaust.
Yeah, nice. And in terms of that perspective, how do you think, I mean, when you talked about the Global March for Gaza, you were talking about hoping to get Arabic news coverage. You weren't under any illusions, obviously, that you were going to make the front page of the Times or the New Zealand Herald through AP or whatever. Western media, right, the elephant in the room, I guess, we obviously don't get the kind of coverage of genocide in general, but Palestine in particular, really ever in my lifetime that we talk about here, right? You have to actually dig to find these things. I just wondered what you thought in terms of how these things have changed over the last few years. Like, my intuition is that only recently has there been a little more kind of critique from establishment media sources of, you know, the Israeli media line. But even then, it's so shallow that it's essentially meaningless. What do you think in terms of the last few years? How the kind of media perspective has shifted, if at all?
I guess I always expected that there was so much tension there between what they were doing and the truth, that when the dam broke, it would create an absolute deluge of change. And no, I think this process is a lot more managed than we think. And I think that they use small admissions in order to create capital to, in fact, twist things in the other direction. You know, there's this tendency now amongst organizations and governments to address what's happening in Gaza by saying we're against the settlements in the West Bank and we're going to take tokenistic action against them. And that somehow, like, they're using that as a kind of, I don't know what you'd call it, pallywashing to try and, inoculate themselves against having to be, well, against the fact that they are totally complicit in a genocide in a very legal sense. I mean, they are literally committing an international crime by supporting a genocide. So, you know, and it seems that nothing we have done yet has managed to make them fear the reality of their potential liability for legal consequences, and also, I mean, the future factor of how awful they're going to look because of their recorded positions on a genocide. That seems to matter a lot less to authorities all around the world than the current reality of needing to be obeisant to the US and toe the line, you know? So when will it change? You know, I mean, once it does start changing, it should theoretically be this, you know, the dam collapsing and a sudden flood and rats leaving the sinking ship and many other metaphors, you know, perhaps rats leaving the sinking dam. I don't know. but, you know,
it should be unreal, like that,
but I just don't know what to expect anymore because the things that should happen just don't happen, you know?
We've crossed so many Rubicons, right? It's absolutely bizarre. Like, Israel's now attacking Iran, TBC, committing genocide, a Holocaust in Palestine, bombing Lebanon, occupying Syria, fighting with Houthis from Yemen. Like, how much more does it take, right? This is a nuclear-armed rogue state in the Middle East with support, seemingly just unlimited financial and military support from the military-industrial complex in the US and further afield. Like, there's no light really between the UK and the US on that. The EU's been pretty subservient. NATO has been worse. Australia has been half a step behind. You know, New Zealand maybe two steps behind, but still, you know, we're all on that that warpath. It's absolutely brutal and really just I don't know, heartbreaking and horrific to see the kind of drums of war. But the Iran thing, we do need to talk about Iran because that's the story of the week. It's obviously evolving fast. We don't know what a dishonest, capricious entity like the US is going to do tomorrow. So, you know, this will be dated by the time we release it. But how does that fit in? There's obviously a different kind of geopolitical angle post the Hezbollah pager attacks, the likelihood and types of attack, I suppose, that could be kind of reconstituted has changed. But I don't think the kind of cutting the head off the snake thing from Israel has really done as much as they would like to have thought that it would, because Iran's an actual country with a military apparatus and millions, 90-something million people, and you can't turn off an enemy like that. And latest intel looks like Trump's bunker buster kind of attacked into what he said. You know, who could have guessed Trump was lying and over-egging, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, how does that fit geopolitically, apart from anything else?
Well, I mean, it really is hard to know what Trump's role in this is. But of course, the neocons desperately want to say that the nuclear program is going ahead, and, you know, because it provides them a pretext for further attacks. This attack didn't come out of the blue. It wasn't prompted by Israel's actions. This is what people have been in the US have been working towards for a very long time. Now, I mean, there are two ways of looking at this. Either Trump has kind of been pushed into doing an attack and is trying to use that into saying, right, now it's done, it's all over. Or, you know, this is all a bit of a con anyway. Trump has channeled this sort of Richard Nixon madman theory recently. Like, as well as George W. Bush, which he's, you know, very much on the same page with in some ways. I'm the decider, but nobody knows what I'm going to do, blah, blah, blah. And Nixon, of course, said this was a negotiating ploy. And of course, that's not really the truth. This is a propaganda ploy to create room to do things that are really insupportable, you know. And that's how they used it. They didn't use it as a negotiating ploy. That's just a pretext that, you know, the US has been claiming that the enemies don't want to negotiate with them right back to 1951 when they're like doing everything they could do to avoid peace breaking out in Korea, and then saying these commies, they don't want to negotiate with us. You know, at one point Lyndon Johnson went on TV and said, you know, that you know, we want peace, but the Vietnamese won't negotiate with us. And the Vietnamese saw that and went, yes, we'll negotiate with you. Here's what we want to, you know, here's the terms we want to negotiate on, as you do when you start. And you just held up the terms and said, see, I told you they didn't want to negotiate. So, you know, this is normal for the US. They don't do negotiations. They want, if you think about what they want to do to Iran, it's what they did to Libya, what they did to Somalia, Sudan, South Sudan, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq. They want to destroy the country, leave it in a permanent state of civil conflict, totally unable to reconstitute itself as a powerful state. Oh, I forgot Afghanistan, of course. This is what they're doing. They're doing this in country after country after country. And to be clear, technically, this is all genocide. These are attacks against peoples as such. You know, it's incidental. If they want regime change in Iran, that's incidental. That's not the purpose. The purpose is not to get their new buddies in, because their new buddies aren't going to be loyal to them because the country's got oil. You know, if they could have done that, they would have done that with, you know, Iraq, and they would have kept the loyal regime in Iran after they threw Mossadegh.
They've tried enough times, right? This is decades of trying loyal regimes.
You can't really, a well-populated, oil-rich country, no leader is going to remain permanently compliant with an imperial master. They will start to look eye up development of their own resources, you know, unless, you know, I mean, Saudi Arabia is a little bit of an exception, but basically this is why the US has been gunning for all of the Middle Eastern countries for so long. And why they have, I mean, you know, the US doesn't use Middle Eastern oil, it doesn't rely on it. It wants to dominate it so it can control economic activity and military activity in the rest of the world. That's why they have the Carter Doctrine, which says that they regard the movement of oil through the Straits of Hormuz as their national interest. So, you know, and that's the reality. Now, Trump is, what exact role he's playing in this is very, it's just like, it could be that he's just misdirection. You know, you think of how hard he came out against Israel and dropping the F-bomb. Very dramatic, very, very dramatic. But, you know, like, if you were wanting to set up a narrative where it turns out that actually the Iranians are the ones who are the real baddies, that actually creates a bit of room for that. And I hope I'm wrong that that's, you know, I hope that that isn't the reality. I hope, in fact, that he doesn't, the neocons have tried to push him into all-out war with Iran, and he just doesn't want to, and a lot of people around him don't want to either. And so he's just tried to kind of do a token attack. But yeah, again, like, you know, they're not letting go. They're leaking stuff about how the nuclear facilities are all intact. And of course, Iran, who seem to want to cling on to the nuclear enrichment purely as a negotiating ploy, which blows my mind. I don't really understand what I don't quite see the logic in that. But I mean, they don't really have a weapons program, and having 60%
enriched
uranium
isn't doing much for them, eh?
Doesn't make a weapon. It just makes you a target. So I don't really understand their logic. I don't understand. I mean, the US is often blessed with very good enemies.
Yes.
So, for example, Saddam Hussein, once, you know, he was given a green light to invade Kuwait. But once the US showed that they clearly were going to use his invasion of Kuwait to attack his country, he should have just pulled out. Instead, he stayed there and he's talked about the mother of all battles, and he acted like he was going to be able to use his possession of Kuwait as a negotiating ploy. And of course, the US did everything possible to avoid negotiating, just like they did in 2003. You know, like when the Iraqis tried to be so comprehensive about their proof that they didn't have weapons of mass destruction, they produced a file that was like two phone books thick, and handed it over, and they And the US kind of used the bulk of it to sort of suggest, oh, look what they're hiding. It's like, you know, it's too
Yeah.
big. It
To
would be so,
prove a negative, right? It was
So
always.
yeah, this is the way they work, and I honestly think if people understood how malevolent and relentless they are, they probably wouldn't try to negotiate with them. They would just try to not give them the excuse to attack their country.
How much excuse do they
That is my
need,
opinion.
right? I mean,
Oh, I think they do need, and particularly now more than ever, they need narratives that sell things for people. I mean, they really can't, you know, once they start looking like purely like the bad guy, then it really starts to stick. If it's a mistake, you know, if it's a, you know, like do-gooding gone wrong, if it's because of some idiots in the White House, or, you know, ideologues in the White House, or whatever, it's fine. But if you actually like start to see the pure calculation and the systematic behavior that goes from one country to another doing the same thing every time, if that becomes a mainstream way of perceiving them, then they're kind of sunk. You know, they require a certain level of manufactured assent from the international community. Now, you know, we know from when they were building up that sort of compliance for the attack on Iraq, that they use a lot of kompromat, you know, and they get the goods on the international diplomats and international leaders as much as possible. But those people can only be co-opted if they have a public excuse. So if we look at what's happening around the world today, I think we see this playing out, because we have many, many leaders around the world doing morally insupportable things to support Israel, or to fail in their obligations to oppose Israel. And their excuses are wearing pretty thin, quite frankly. But they're still, like, you know, what with the Western media compliance and everything else, they still manage to play as if, like, you know, as if nobody could know. And that's what they'll say eventually. Oh, nobody could know, you know. The big line with Tony Blair was, nobody could doubt his sincerity, you know. It's like, yeah, he did this really bad thing, but nobody could doubt that he meant well, you know. And I think that is incredibly important to them. Otherwise, they'll all end up in prison, for example.
Yeah, the meaning well thing is just absolutely insane, right? That's kind of always been a thing in the West, but it's funny that that's all they have to fall back on now. It's like meaning well and hard power. Like, you know, we're almost beyond the point of thinking that there's some kind of coherent, ideologically structured, better world that we're kind of working towards. People who aren't in the ruling classes sure don't feel like that. You know, polls are turning against adventurism or regime change, the American R word of du jour, I guess. But it is quite funny that that's kind of all they've got to fall back on is I'm saving the world and I've got the nukes, right? And I mean, why wouldn't you? Like, if I was Iran, this is when I would go, okay, turned out we did need nukes 30 years ago. Because look, why be at the negotiating table when the table's just been blown up and your negotiators have been assassinated? Like, you know, this is the first time that you're like, okay, well, there's nothing else that the US will respect other than, you know, someone
And
North Korea style op opponent.
I mean, that's the sort of thing that actually pundits on the mainstream media sort of mention sometimes. That's the sort of thing that even they can grasp. And you know, that sort of thing does sink in with people. They kind of understand a little bit that, you know, this is, you know, I think that Iran's not really necessarily the bad guy in this scenario. What they don't understand is that Iran isn't trying to build a nuclear weapon, you know. So it kind of, again, you know, it's a bit confusing in that sense. But then, you know, they have so many people who have just a pure racist gut reaction against Iran and Iranians as well. That is really at a fundamental level. And And I'm surprised as well at the number of people who are like that with Palestinians too. I didn't even really notice a lot of heavy-handed anti-Palestinian racism in the last 30, 40 years or whatever, but it's clearly sunk in at some level with a lot of people that Palestinians are by nature violent terrorist people who teach their children to hate and so forth.
Yeah, I don't know. We missed that class maybe
Yeah.
in school, but who knows? So, yeah, I don't know. It's the effectiveness of international propaganda, I suppose, and these kind of horizontal models. Yeah, Lord knows. I mean, Libya's the model, right? Don't give up your nukes is the lesson I think we've all learned over the last few decades. Don't give the US an inch because they'll take your leadership and everything. Everything that goes along with it. But in terms of just quickly, we should wrap up soon. But I wanted to kind of, you know, foolhardily forecast potential what could happen over the next short time. Just you mentioned the Straits of Hormuz. That's what one in three barrels of oil, I think, as of a few years ago, went through there. So that's not just not nothing. That is like world shattering economic repercussions potential, right? It's only what 20 miles wide, like that's Iran's for the controlling as soon as they want. So I mean, what level of, no pun intended, nuclear response would it take, I suppose, from Iran to make that move?
I mean, that's something they always have up their sleeve, you know. As far as I know, there's no way that naval vessels can safely defend against their missiles. So you'd be sending, like, you know, if you think of the missiles are much, much cheaper than the naval ships. Yeah, I don't think there was ever going to be any sort of decapitation strike that would take out all of that capability. But, you know, I'm not an expert on this. This is just what I've heard. I mean, the thing is, another thing, of course, is that if you know the timing of when people are going to rattle sabers and then sign peace agreements or whatever, you can make a lot of money. And we can assume that because it's so commercially important, we can assume that some people have been doing that as well. And Iran is probably, I think maybe this might be, you know, the time when the people who've been clamoring to attack Iran have to climb down. It's going to fizzle out. I can't, it's too big. And, you know, the global war on terror was declared as a 30-year war, right? And people have been asking recently, is this World War III? It feels like World War III. And it's kind of like, well, it's been going on for 25 years now, you know? And sometimes there have been a lot more people dying than now. Certainly been many more people displaced at other times. So, and Tehran was, well, Iran was meant to be the kind of crescendo, I think, in a lot of people's minds. But it just, I think it might be a bridge too far. I think they are drawing the functioning of their own states. They're asking NATO countries to spend 5% of GDP on military, and this is military, you know, hardware from the US. This is, you know, basically economic. This is
it's a racket.
Paying tribute to the US, probably not going to increase their military capabilities anything even remotely in line with the amount that they're spending on it. The US is eating itself from within. There's all these geeks who are lining themselves up to be warlords without realizing that, you know, that once the law doesn't count, then the guy standing next to them with the gun who they think they hire will actually just blow their brains out or point the gun at their heads and say, you do what me and the lads say now, you know. But, you know, they think they're warlords, and that's they're going, they quite seem to be quite happy to dismantle society. And we unfortunately have to live with the consequences of that. But it does mean that, like, the dreams of securing the global US Reich for another 1,000 years are probably going to die with that because of the dysfunction.
Absolutely. I mean, they're disregarding soft power, which is what they had. It's crazy. That's absolutely shooting yourself in the foot. Like after spending half a century plus really cementing your place as the global hegemon, to say actually that's not what made us powerful, you know, it was this insanely kind of sclerotic, inefficient military-industrial complex that everyone loves around the world, you know. That's really what will endear us to the billions of people that we need to preside over. Just insane. Just like terminal hegemon brain, where you can't imagine a future, right? That doesn't exist with you on top. That future can exist and is about to exist. So yeah, I tend to agree. Like I think it almost doesn't matter the kind of tactical decisions that America makes in terms of where we'll be in a decade, because they're going down the gurgler strategically, you know, whether they choose to strike Iran a tiny bit or not at all. But you know, it's no comfort to the thousands of people, thousands of innocent civilians who will die.
No, yeah. I mean, that's the tragedy of it all, isn't it? Like, this flailing empire causing misery. But, you know, yeah, I mean, we know it will fall and we have to hasten that decline, I think.
Exactly, and that's why we're here. Let's
Yeah.
wrap on that cheery note. Here to hasten the decline of empire. Thank you, Kieran. Did you want to leave our listeners with a final note where they can find you, what you're about to write or record?
I'm just about to post something about the some of the charming people on Sky News Australia describing our activities over in Egypt, and I mean, our media are bad and some of the media are better, but we don't have anything quite like that, I have to say.
Awesome. All right, stay tuned. I'll post a link to your blog for people to catch
Thank
you.
you.
And if anyone isn't following on genocide.com, do it. Kieran does awesome work. Thank you. Have a good week. Kieran, thanks so much for
And
coming
you.
along. Cheers. Thanks, everybody. That's been another week for one of 200 New Zealand's left-wing independent politics media podcast. We will catch you next time. Bye-bye.
If our faces are then I'm living a pointless life, but I'm learning all your lessons. Fucking politics is no distinction. The roads are far now. It's paved with good intentions. And I'll admit that I'm at a loss for what to say when the crisis is across me or to stay. Cause I live amongst the people every day. This vindictive, forgetful fucking rain. It feels like we're on the road to hell.